notes on the fourth interview with Jesse Haver Butler. Interview identified as Roman numeral 3. The previous interview jumped over this period and discussed some suffrage reminiscences and is noted as A3. The interview took place on January 15th in Jesse's apartment, as usual. She was feeling considerably better than at the time of the last interview and was not as nervous, although she did seem to have some minor voice problems and got tired much more easily. The interview covered the period beginning with her job for the Minimum Wage Commission in Boston. The previous interview had somewhat touched upon how she got the job and her difficulties when she first arrived in Boston to take it. She went into detail about the job and also about the difficulties of a single woman living in a city alone. Then we covered the period of her working in Washington, D.C., first for the Bureau of Labor Statistics and later as the lobbyist and secretary of the National Consumers League. She described in detail the manner in which she went about lobbying for the minimum wage bill for Washington, D.C. She also discusses some of her social life in Washington, D.C., although more of this should be explored in the next interview, particularly the information on the communal living, etc. Also, her feelings about her marriage, the ending of her career, and her work as a League of Women Voters lobbyist will be covered next time.
I, Jesse Haver Butler, give notice of intention to copyright this text on this 15th day of January, 1973. Well, Helen Hill was the name of the skilled statistician that had now taken my job before I got to Boston. So I took Helen Hill out to lunch. She was a typical little New England woman, small, plainly dressed, demure type, but very skilled. And she was living with her father and taking care of her father very humbly. So I had the inspiration to take her to a big hotel to lunch, which was a real treat. I doubt if she'd ever been in any of those big hotels. And after, while we were eating our lunch, I began to discuss with her the situation that I had run into in this Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission, which was now a state commission passed through the state legislature, forming it, ordering the formation of a state commission board to do a thorough investigation of the whole question of the employment of women in the state of Massachusetts, where there was tremendous exploitation as women were just beginning to get out of their homes and going into industry, into factories, into stores and laundries. Candy factories were some of the big factories in Massachusetts, and stocking factories. Then they were silk stocking factories. And they were, according to the law passed by the state legislature, the employers had to let the Minimum Wage Commission copy their payrolls, which was really a single amazing thing that such a law could have been passed. But that was the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Minimum Wage Society that got that law passed, as strict a law as that. And so there was to be a tremendous research taken up, beginning with the copying of payrolls in some of the worst industries, the candy industry, the brush industry, the laundry industry, the restaurants, and the stores. I remember specifically the brush industry was very large and one of the very worst. And then the after the payrolls were copied, The material had to be brought back and thrown on to into a statistical report with drawings and curves and all that sort of thing. Very complicated use of the material had to be made. And Amy Hughes had taken a year, I think several years, of leave from Mount Holyoke College, where she was teaching economics and sociology. And she was put in charge then of this minimum wage commission right on Beacon Street, not far from the Capitol. And there was a board, too, of citizens, both men and women, who were to supervise this whole study. So it was a very thoroughly worked out and sound performance, because after they got the facts of all these industries, then they had to form a board in that industry. And on the board were to be, I think, five or six employers and five or six employees and three people to represent the public. And then the board was to meet and talk about how much it cost a girl in that industry or woman to live. And this was all very scientifically and intelligently worked out. I feel the women of today owe a great debt to that study that was made in that particular place, of all others, was one of the best. And I think they owe a great debt to that original work that did reveal the whole danger of the exploiting of the labor of women, ruthlessly exploitation. They would have never got the story otherwise. So then this board had to sit down with the employees and go over their budget and what it cost for those employees to live in the very most modest way imaginable. And then the board had to decide what that industry wages should, that what wages that industry should pay its women so that they could just live. And if they didn't pay it, they were publicized in the press. And this, of course, was not very helpful to the industry. They were not fined. There was no authority to fine them. It was just publicized that they were employing people below the minimum wage. So, of course, as soon as I arrived over there, I was fascinated with the opportunity that would come to me to have such an experience in the beginnings of such a great movement that I sensed was just starting, the employment of women outside their homes. So anyway, at luncheon, Helen and I talked over the situation, and she was not one of these. She was a technician of the first order, not a dreamer or a theoretical thinker. And she hadn't thought this all out, what this meant. All she understood was how to take this vast material and throw it accurately into a statistical study so that that industry would know what the condition was in that industry. She was skilled in that. So I pointed out to her that one of my assets was that people liked to work for me and always had. And since we were going to have a large employment of people in that office, I think it came to 8 or 10 employees eventually, I suggested to her that we form a corporation between us, not a triumvirate, a two-person triumvirate, and that she would engineering the statistical end of it, and I would do what my part would be to go to some of those industries and copy those payrolls so I could get the feeling of the industry and get the picture of it. And then I would have a lot to do with the employees and the supervision of the employees. She was a petty little type of person that people hated to work for, because if she found one column incorrectly added, she would go and report it to the Miss Hughes, to Dr. Amy Hughes, and that person would be in trouble. But and that's what had happened to me, of course. As soon as I got up there, I signed up a column and made a mistake on adding. I was not good in mathematics anyway. But this is something one could learn, as I found out afterwards. So anyway, I said also that I didn't think she'd be happy in her life if she would use the situation that existed to force me now to lose this opportunity that I wanted, and I'd have to go back to New York and find another job. And I didn't think that this was something that she'd want to do to anybody. So she saw that point, and we left there in the finest of humor and called on Miss Hughes and explained what we saw. Principally, I did. What we saw was the future of this job and why each of us were expertly qualified to help make a success of that department. And this we did. It was a very great experience. I'll never forget what happened to me when I was sent to Northampton, where Smith College is and where I'd been a graduate, to copy the payroll in a huge stocking factory there that I used to walk by as a spoiled college, high-living college student of Smith College. And many times I'd walk past this stocking factory, and now I was inside the stocking factory copying payrolls and seeing the people who worked there and getting the atmosphere and feeling of what it was like not to be at Smith College, but to be an employee on a very meager wage in a great factory like that. It was really a shocking experience, a contrast.
Did you have a chance to talk to the women workers, or did you just copy the
No,
people?
They were very careful not to let us talk to the women workers, and of course, I was there as an official. I was an official in the state of Massachusetts. I had to pass an examination, and I was a statistical employee. So, of course, we were not given any opportunity to have any personal experiences with the employees, and it would have been unethical for us to have tried to do it. But it was a great experience. I did a lot of copying in that industry and in the candy industry and the restaurant industry, where also women worked for no wage whatever and were utterly dependent on their tips to survive. And of course, that still is very much true today. Finally, of course, I learned how to add. One can learn how to add, and for which I'm very grateful. It's a useful qualification to be able to handle figures. And then I have a certain amount of ESP in me, and I could sense when things were inaccurate and they weren't going right without having to find the figures. Also, I had the opportunity of attending a good many of the sessions of those boards, where the employees, for the first time in their lives, were given a chance to talk to the employers. So, as human beings on that board, they had to begin to exchange knowledge and information. And the material that the employers got from their employees, of course, gave them a severe shock. They just hadn't sat down and thought it out. So that finally, when the different boards were formed and came to a decision on what the minimum wage was, there was built a different attitude between the women that worked in those industries and the employers, and I think they gradually learned to better use their talented. Many very talented women got into those jobs.
Now, Jesse, was there a board for each industry,
yeah,
in other words?
Yeah, there was a separate board for the candy industry, the brush industry. And the theory was, of course, that in some of the industries, the occupations were less complicated than in others. For instance, in the candy industry, where a great deal of handwork has to be done, delicate handwork on each little piece of candy, women are skilled at that, as the men can't work in those industries at all. And so it made it necessary for them to pay a higher wage for those industries because the women were particularly qualified to work in that kind of work, and it was harder to get them unless they paid more money.
Now, how did they pick which employees were going to be on the board? Did Did each factory, did the workers themselves?
Oh, no, the workers had to pick those. Oh, no, they didn't, they weren't, the employers were not allowed to pick the ones. And although they had no unions, the employers gave the workers a place to meet and select their representatives. They were cooperative because part of our work in getting these figures was to create a cooperative attitude with the employers, and I enjoyed that very much. Now, I was very good at that. I know how to get men to cooperate, and I was gracious, and I made them see that not only were they important businessmen, but they were a part of the fiber of American industry.
Now, this was, you began there in about 1913, then.
Yes.
Now, was the...
I was there 4 years.
And was the Massachusetts Trade Union League involved at all? Did you have any association with them?
Well, they weren't too enthusiastic about it because right from the beginning they were unhappy at having women. I think they had the 8-hour law soon after that. And I think the unions were a little unhappy about having women have this specialized attention as to wages, although their wages were not comparable to what the union wages were. But most of these factories, most of the employees in these factories were women. So that the unions, which were all men mostly, although I remember there was the women's trade union movement there somewhat and had been encouraged, but of course none of the big stores would take any woman who was in a trade union, and very few of the industries would employ women if it was known they were in the trade union. There was great antagonism. You remember some of the big scandalous union stories came out of Massachusetts around about this time. And now I'd like to say a word about my living conditions that I think American women ought to do something about. Here you are, you've been to a college, you've been in a cultural environment of the first order, and then you go to work as an individual person in a city. You've no place to live that's decent. You've no companionship. How are you going to find out anybody for companions? You've been used to 4 years of perfectly delightful companionship. And this is a gap in all the big cities. I suffered from it in New York City and in Boston, and the worst of it one is in Washington. There ought to be a movement to have social centers for women, especially, where they can go and have parties and meet people and dance and have clubs and play games and so forth. But a girl, a woman like me, going to Boston alone, where am I going to find any kind of companionship? And just amusing, I went into a boarding house on Beacon Hill, which was right back of the Capitol, and ate in this boarding house. And there were a lot of young men there, and a young man, a Portuguese, began to get interested in me and took me swimming. In fact, taught me how to swim. Well, it was by the grace of God that I didn't marry that Portuguese. He was not a college man. He was a very low-type man, really. But I had no companionship, no place to meet, or opportunity to meet the type of men and women that I was used to. Where are you going to find those? Where are you going to meet them? And I had a tremendous love affair, the first one of my life, with this Portuguese young man. And the reason why it fell through, I happened to be a person that dreams a lot, and I had a very bad dream about him, and it killed the romance. And I could have easily married that man, and because I was beginning to be anxious to have a home and a normal life of a woman, and I wasn't getting it. Before I met this Portuguese, I happened to adore swimming, and of course Boston is horrible in the summer with terrible heat. And so the minute my work was over there, I think it was at 4:30 or 5, I got on a streetcar and went down to the harbor, the Boston Harbor, where there was a huge free swimming pool, swimming facility, free, right down on the edge of the slum section of Boston, and an enormous building where one could dress and leave your clothes and go out and swim in the harbor. And I used to, every night, after I would have passed out without that swimming. I don't think I'd have survived. The heat is so horrible, and I felt it terribly. So I used to go down there and swim, and I would swim way out in the harbor where there were the private boats were moored, the different little yachts and boats that people used to swim around in. And I'd climb up on one of those boats and lie out on the deck and have a sun bath or rest and so forth. And so one night I was lying out on the deck of this boat, and oh, the swimming, I think that's the best swimming I ever did. It was perfectly beautiful. Just saved my life. There was a girl swimming at the foot of the boat, and a cute-looking, pretty girl, and I called her out to her to come up and join me, and so she did. And she was a clerk in one of those wholesale industries right down there on Boston Harbor. So after that, we met regularly and swam together out on and laid out on top of the different boats. And I found out that she was a Polish Jewess. And so she invited me then to her home, not very far from where I lived. It was right back of where I lived, in a very much of a slum section. And I was taken up to the apartment of her Jewish home, and there was her Polish Jewish mother dressed as the Jewish women did dress in Poland, the hair and the costume and so on. And she had brought over 8 children from Poland, and they had lived in the slums, and this was the youngest of all the 8 children. So by the time she got into school, they were well off enough to keep her in school through high school and through college. And all her evenings she spent in the Boston Public Library. I didn't see very many other young people in that library, but she was there, and she'd read everything, and she was one of the best educated girls I had ever met. She spoke perfect English. She had a cultured manner about her, and she was very pretty. She had lovely blue eyes and so on. So I whipped her up to go to the law school to take her graduate work, and she's now one of the leading lawyers of Boston.
Are you still in touch with her?
I haven't seen her the last few years, but every time I went to Boston, I did go to see her. I got to know her very well. I was fascinated with this girl. And of course, this, you know, dear, this is what makes America so great. We are a conglomeration of people like that, with the capacity of she came evidently from Poland, certainly not from the lowest class of people, because she had a great mind and a great character. And you know, she went to that Boston Public Library for years, and she had read all the great works of Tolstoy, Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells. She was better read, really, than I was, although I spent a lot of time reading too. But she was thoroughly cultured, educated woman, and I sicked her on to being a lawyer.
So she became your companion then in Boston?
Oh yes, I saw her all the years I was in Boston. She was my best companion.
Now, did you live in a boarding house the entire time?
No, I lived in a rooming house right near the boarding house, and they didn't have rooms, they just served meals right around the corner on Pinckney Square. It's a very famous square with some beautiful homes on that square, but this was a beautiful home, and the woman had needed to earn money, and so she turned it into a boarding house, and that's where I met my Portuguese boyfriend.
No,
but I had sunk him by the time that I met my Polish girlfriend, and I'll think of her name in a few minutes. I think they had, oh, I know, it was Small. They had lost their Jewish name and took on this Small, S-M-A-L-L, and I've forgotten what her first name was. But she now, became one of my best friends.
You lived in a rooming house and then took your meals in this...
In the boarding house, see.
Did you live in the same place the whole 4 years you were there?
Yes. I lived right on Pinckney Square, it was called. A very area, very beautiful homes, except this particular home had a dining room, you know, boarding house, and good meals, so it was fun going there for dinners. I think I did some. I got my breakfast in my room, and I got my lunch downtown near where I worked.
Wait, did you have a room to yourself?
Oh, yes, I had a lovely room, beautiful room.
How much did you have to pay for your room?
Oh, I'm sorry, dear, I've forgotten that. It was an exceedingly nice room on the third floor of a big old house right down on Charles Street. But the back of the room looked onto Pinckney Square, right near Pinckney Square. It's interesting to know, too, that years later, after I'd married and been to England with my nice husband, and then we came back to Needham, Mass., just outside of Boston, and had a beautiful home there, and I had my little Jewish friend there many times. I looked her up. She had married a boy in the Navy, very ordinary boy, much less qualified to be her husband than he was, and the marriage finally blew up. He was just a very low-class type of boy in the Navy, but she had two brilliant children. And, she just did wonders with those children. So this is an example of America and the conglomeration of which we're made up that the British never have understood. That's why they can't understand us today, because the British, of course, really are made up of just two nations, Anglo-Saxon and the Normans. And so they can't understand why we do the things we do. And, of course, it is this conglomeration of people. And that I would meet this extraordinary girl down on the back of a little boat in the harbor of Boston is amazing. But it's an example of how terribly unhappy a woman like me can be once you get into a city. And I had the same experiences in New York and the same in Boston. I think when I talked to you about New York and how I worked at the Macmillan Publishing Company and later the Pulitzer School of Journalism. My social life in New York was rather erratic too. So do you want me to tell you a little bit? No, that's another story. Anyway, at the end of 4 years there in Boston.
The whole 4 years in just you. Spent going to the factories and copying down the payroll.
And helping to make the statistical results of those factories, and then sitting on the boards that took those statistics and threw them into resolutions on what those employees should pay. So you see, in the 4 years, I feel very grateful for those 4 years because I had a severe and beautiful training all the way through. On industry and government. I got excited about the government up at the Capitol there in Boston, and I used to go and a lot of the hearings that took place off and on this minimum wage. And I went and participated. I'm particularly interested in government, as it proved later when I became a lobbyist in Washington. So this 4 years in Boston was undoubtedly a tremendous training course for me.
Now, was the Massachusetts Consumers League involved at all? Were you in contact with them?
I was in constant contact with them, but they were the ones that got that law passed. So, of course, and they did have some very fine men and women on their board and on their committee. Mm-hmm. They were really back of the whole thing.
Now, you mentioned the first time we talked that this was the beginning of your real desire to help women.
That's when I really, I became dedicated in a way to the woman's world and the woman's needs. And of course, that dedication was really backed by the tragedy of my own family life and my mother's death at 10 and how I had lived in that valley where no family, no woman in any family that gave birth to the children lived to bring them up. I was lived in a area, you see, when there's no phones, no doctors, no cars. It was the primitive life of early America. And I had seen and suffered personally the terrible experience as a girl and a woman and my mother as it developed in that kind of an environment. So I began to be interested then because, you see, I'm a Libra, and a Libra person's, the keynote of Libra is balance and justice. And I didn't think it was justice for women to suffer like that. Now I'm finding women suffering in industry. So all down the line, it seemed to me, it was a bad world for women. And I wanted to help change it.
So when you saw the kind of wages these women were getting, really had quite an effect on you.
And how they had to survive, try to survive. Most of them, really, went and lived with, stayed with their families. So, of course, they were not paying for their keep with these wages. Or they had men friends that they lived with. They had to do one or the other. Neither one was justice because they were not carrying their own weight, you see. They couldn't earn enough to survive without help from either their families or their boyfriends. And I didn't think that was just. I remember, of course, that was the era, and this you need to know, when Edward A. Feline built the biggest, most beautiful woman's store in Boston. And all this shouting about a minimum wage had got to his ear, so he paid from the beginning the highest minimum wage that was ever paid, $8 a week, which was unheard of in those days when the women were getting $4 and $5 a week. He paid $8 a week minimum. So he got the finest women, saleswomen in his store. His store was beautiful. It had a big organ that played music all the time. And these beautiful, attractive girls, beautifully dressed to serve you. And so his store thrived from the beginning. And he had another cute idea, too. If dresses hung on the racks upstairs a certain length of time, he kept them a little longer, and then he moved them to the basement at half price and got rid of them down there. So everybody who wanted to save money went down to the basement, and they got just as nice clothes as were upstairs, only a little later. And right on the street, here is a plug for Home Savings Bank, one of the biggest savings banks in America. Right on Tremont Street, just half a block from my office, I started my savings account at Home Savings, and so that when I got married, I had $5,000 in that little bank. But I didn't tell my husband about it when I got married. He thought I was penniless. And I thought he was penniless. He had $4,500 holed up somewhere. And when we got to London one day, we got to talking about money, and I said, oh, I have a confession to make. And I confessed the $5,000, and then he confessed the $4,500, and we didn't think we were penniless.
So you were making, you said before, $1,300
a year.
Mm-hmm. So you were able to save quite a bit.
Oh, yes.
Your salary.
I plucked down $25 before I cashed my check. I went right into that Home Savings Bank, and because I loved I happened to like clothes, and I like pretty clothes, so the only thing to do was to pluck the money down into Home Savings Bank before I cashed my check.
So it cost you about $75 a month then to live,
yeah.
What you lived on.
Mm-hmm. Well, 25 from, yes.
Because mm-hmm. you were getting a little over 100 a month.
That's right, yeah. I got by on $75. Well, very well. I did very well on it. But I just got rid of that $25 before I started getting rid of it in other ways.
Now, by the time you left then, the minimum wage had already been established.
Oh, yes. And quite a number of boards were at work with it. So when I left there as a employee of the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, D.C., at a much higher job.
Why did you decide to leave?
Heard about the World War I was on, and I heard that the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics was looking for statisticians to do a survey of the cost of living in Washington, D.C. And so I wrote of my experience, was immediately invited down for an interview, and immediately got a job for the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, D.C., so I was under civil service. And my experience in Boston got me there at once.
And what was that job paying?
stop a minute, I have to think. So at that, you want to do it? So I found myself in Washington, D.C., at $1,500 a year in a very fine, respectable job, of course, with the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it was a valuable experience to get into the government like that. Again, though, I found myself in Washington alone without any way of finding companions and so on. But at that time, beautiful canal that ran along by the side of the Potomac River clear up to West Virginia was still operating. And on that canal, all the coal from West Virginia was still coming down in coal boats pulled by mules down this canal. It was the most beautiful spot you've ever seen. And right near it was a big canoe outlet. And so I found a woman in the boarding house where I was who liked to canoe, and we immediately bought a canoe and began spending all our weekends going clear up almost to West Virginia in that canal in our canoe. And then I began to get friends because everybody that liked to canoe was on the canal, including my future husband, in canoes. And then later we pushed them over into the Potomac River and canoed way up the Potomac River and find hideouts on the other side for weekends, and we had a lark. It was perfectly beautiful life.
But so you lived in a rooming house?
I lived on a rooming house right not very far from the White House. I guess it was about 3 or 4 blocks from the White House, not far from Lafayette Square, which is right in front of the White House. And I immediately, of course, got interested in the woman suffrage movement that was going on. And Alice Paul had her house, her lovely house, right on the edge of Lafayette Square with a big dining room. And so I took a great many of my luncheons there when I was working in this United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. And that was a fascinating job. We had to go around all over Washington, where the civil servants lived. Of course, Washington is a city of enormous crowds of civil servants. I think it's nearly 1 million live in there, in row houses, in sort of row houses, small brick row houses. They're very common to that part of the world. And we had to go out and just ring doorbells and go in and get the woman's whole budget. What her money was, how she was spending it, for everything, to see if the civil service people were getting enough to live on. And those were the statistics that we were making, and I knew now how to make statistics and how to interview people, and especially am I very good at that sort of interviewing. And so I was there 2 years, and I just adored it because it was a The war was on. It was a great experience to be involved in that kind of a statistical survey, you see.
Now, was when you came to Washington, was that your first association with the suffrage movement?
Yes, first close association. In Washington, I went to a lot of their meetings, a great many meetings on birth control. Margaret Sanger was always coming up there and lecturing, because they had a very bad law in Massachusetts and no information on birth control. And I went several times and heard Mrs. Pankhurst speak every time she came there. I went to all the big suffrage meetings in Boston while I was there, but I couldn't do much about it at that time because I was just so busy working. But when I got down there, then I began going to Alice Paul's place And that's where I met Hazel Humpkins and all these other people.
Now, when did you start your relationship with the Consumers League?
Well, then towards the end of the second year, I got very well acquainted with the woman who was running the Washington, D.C. Consumers League. And she took a great fancy to me, and she was, I can't think of her name now, but she was very clever woman and very much interested in the women's movement and in the minimum wage movement. And so finally she had to leave or go away or something, and she offered me the job of being secretary of the Consumers League. And of course the secretary had to raise all the money. I liked it because I was my own boss and could run the whole show, and very wonderful women were the executive committee of that Consumers League, brilliant Washington women that otherwise I would have never gotten to know at all. You can live in Washington all your life and not know women like that. And among them was the two sister-in-laws of Justice Brandeis. And they were very prominent in that Consumers League. And Florence Kelly, of course, kept coming down to Washington.
You knew Florence Kelly.
Well, she was the national chairman of it. And so I began doing some very, very brilliant work at raising money. And I've forgotten what the issues were, except to get a minimum wage law for the District of Columbia. Because in order to get it for the District of Columbia, the Congress had to pass it. United States Congress, because the United States government rules the District of Columbia. And so it was immediately, you see, a very important place to be working for the minimum wage. To get a minimum wage law through the United States Congress was a little different than getting it through the Massachusetts, state of Massachusetts legislature.
Do you recall how much you earned at that?
Oh, I had a good salary. It was better than I'd been getting all along,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, of course, it was dependent on my raising the money to pay it, which was a little awkward. But I had my own office in the Muncie Building. I had my own office, and at times I had secretaries to come and help me do it, run the office. And I gave meetings and lectured at meetings, but not very much lecturing because I hadn't been trained to speak, and I didn't know how to speak. I hadn't been trained, but I did speak.
But it was basically a one-woman operation then.
Yes. Uh-huh. I was the woman.
Right.
And then eventually, when the Goldmarks got the law written that they wanted to get passed from the Congress, and off the record, Justice Brandeis helped write the law, then they asked me would I work at putting it through the Congress.
This was still for the Consumers League.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. And I said, yeah, oh, I would love